Right, so 4.7 over 1.8 is 2.6. So at 2.6 times the size of the key is less than the size of the message, in theory, you can break the system. Okay, let's think about that. In other words, if the message is 2.6 times the size of the key, or greater than 2.6 times the size of the key, the code is breakable, given enough time. Okay, so we have an RSA crypto system. Now, suppose that RSA crypto system has a 1,000-bit key, right? Or a 4,000-bit key. Suppose there's a 4,000-bit key. 4,000 bits is how many bytes? $500, right? Did I get that right? No. Divided by 8. Yeah, 500 bytes of key. So, 2.6 times 500 is 1,300. So, if you encode 1,300 bytes, 1.3K of message with that key, all time, in your total use of that key, you encode 1.3 kilobytes of data or more. In theory, just by looking at that ciphertext, I can uniquely determine your key. Does this hurt? It hurts. Okay, so what's the difference between having a 4,000-bit key and an 8,000-bit key? Oh, 1.3 kilobytes. That's how much I can send another 1.3 kilobytes, or 2.6 kilobytes before, in theory, I can break it. The BES, 56 bits. Big argument. We should make it 120 whatever bits. 112 bits. 56 bytes is what? 56 bits is 7 bytes. 2.6 times 7 is less than 20 bytes. So when you encrypt with BES, after you've encrypted 20 bytes, in theory, I can uniquely determine your key and decrypt it all. Sorry? We can, absolutely. In fact, that's true. You can, in fact, do it. With enough computational power, you can do it, and you have just that much. How about triple dead? Same thing, triple dead just three times. Okay, that's the theoretical limit. Now, the practical limit's another question, because the given enough time is the issue. I want to go through some special cases. Suppose the length of message is equal to the content of the message. In other words, suppose there's no redundancy in the language. If I'm sending random sequence of bits. Okay, we'll do the computation. H of k over such and such. Well, let's see. Size of m minus h of m is equal to 0. So h of k over m is equal to some constant, you know, 1 bit of p over 0 is equal to infinite. It's never 1. The message is never breakable. You can never uniquely determine whether that one bit of P was a zero or a one. You know there are only two possibilities, and yet you can't ever tell which one it was. Okay? So any encryption scheme is really good for sending random numbers. You can try forever to break my key, you'll never do it. Never, ever, ever do it if all I'm sending is random numbers. Of course, what's the value to the person at the other side if I'm sending random numbers? Not a whole lot of value. But there might be value. Okay, the next special case is that the size of key is equal to the size of the message. That's one letter of key for every letter of message, with all the key symbols being truly random. Do the calculation. You get x over x minus something. X over x minus something that's not zero means that that's always greater than one. Right? So unicity distance is never equal to 1. So the code is never, ever, ever breakable. In other words, no matter what the language is, if I have a truly random key, so that every key symbol is chosen completely at random, then, and I use one symbol of key for every symbol of text I'm encoding, then never be able to break it. To mean the symbol text is the same thing. Okay, that's called the perfect system. It's also known as the one-time pad. It got the name one-time pad by its use. What can happen here is the spy gets a pad of paper. And on each pad of paper is written a sequence of letters. We'll assume it's like a Caesar type. Just a sequence of completely random letters. And that guy has a copy and I have a copy, and those are the only two copies. That guy takes the first sheet on his one-time pad, encodes the message as if it was a Caesar cipher, using each letter for a monoalphabetic substitution cipher, letter by letter, encodes the message, takes the first pad, the first sheet off the pad that he just used to code it, lights it on fire, burns it up, stirs it in acid, mixes it with some food, eats it, completely destroys it, so there's no record of it left. Assuming it wasn't written on the pad so that it shows up on an next sheet. Now I have this encoded message that only one person can ever, ever, ever read, and that's the person that has the other copy of that pad. I send them the message. He gets the message, it's simple to decode, tears off the first sheet, uses the decode, gets the original message, writes down the message, burns the encoded message, burns the top sheet of his one-time pad, end of story. It never happened. That's it. It's perfect. It can never be defeated. If you can carry that off properly, it is perfect. It will never be defeated. There is no amount of cryptanalysis that will ever do it. This is demonstrated mathematically by information theory. This is what Shannon did. I just want to note a few things. One of those things is that pseudo-random is not equal to random. Okay, you get lots of people out there that will say, oh, I have a one-time pad crypto system. Nope, even the NSA can't read it. But the way they get those so-called random numbers is not actually random. It might be pseudo-random. It might be generated, for example, by a nonlinear feedback shift register, or sometimes even a linear feedback shift register. That's a shift register, right? It takes a sequence of bits and shifts them over one, and it takes the one that falls off the end, and it feeds it back into the shift register. It might feed it back into the beginning of the shift register, or it might exclusive OR it with some other bit in the shift register. And depending on how it feeds it back, it's either linear or nonlinear. Okay, but it's a feedback shift register. So it keeps shifting around, shifting around, shifting around. And every bit that gets thrown off the end is used to encode the next bit of message. And if you look at the output of the shift register in a naive fashion, it looks like a random sequence of bits. But it's not a random sequence of bits because it's generated from the original set of bits in that linear feedback system. So if there were 50 bits there, there's 50 bits. When you send 2.6 times 50, 130 bits, coded with this, the message is breakable. It works like a one-time pad, but it's not a one-time pad because it's not truly random, it's pseudo-random. So you got to be real careful. It may seem like a one-time pad, but it's not. So the question is, two questions. One of them is, how do we get real random numbers? Not maybe random, not kind of random, but absolutely, positively, truly random. And the answer is, it's pretty damn hard to get really random numbers. You surely can't get it from your computer. Your computer is very, very good at not being random. It has been engineered to very precise specifications to not be random. It's extremely good at not being random. You can't make it non-random if you try. It's hard to make it random. But you can't make it random. You know, you can drop it, and it tries to remember what it said. And if you screw up a bit here and there on the disk, it'll fix it. You screw up a bit in memory, it'll have a parity error. Say, no, I got to fix it. If it has error correcting codes, it'll automatically fix it. If it's just parity, it'll stop the computer and say, no, sorry, you got something random, won't let you run anymore. The people that design computers try very hard to make them not at all random. It's real hard to get randomness out of not randomness. You may think you can get randomness out of your fingers, but you're not exactly random either. Your fingers tend to push certain keys, your fingers tend to have certain timing associated with them. It's real hard. You've got to trust me on this, but you can do lots of experiments to figure it out. It's very hard. There are ways to get pretty random numbers. One of them is you take a noisy diode, and you tune it so that the noise coming out of the diode has a 50-50 probability of producing a voltage high enough to get a 1 or a voltage too low to get a 1. And you sample it every so often, and you get a sequence of 1s and 0s. That may seem pretty random. But suppose I want to make it not so random. What I might be able to do, for example, is induce radio frequency interference, cause your diode to change its threshold a little bit. You have a higher probability of 1s and 0s. There are various mixing techniques, so that if the probability is higher for 1s and 0s, then you XOR it with the inverse of another sequence that it generates, so that the average is now 50-50. But again, it's not truly random. So it's a very hard problem getting random numbers, getting good random numbers. Now, there are people that sell random numbers. They're called digital certificates. All right, I'm sorry, they're not random numbers. They start out with trying to get pretty random numbers, and then they transform them into, mathematically transform them into a key. But the object is that it was generated from a random number. What they're really selling you is not the computation used to generate the key, which is maybe a second or two of computer power. What they're selling you is a random number. And you know what random numbers cost these days? See, for a 4,000-bit random number, I think it costs like $500. Pretty expensive for a random number, you know? For a real cheap random number, I think you can get them for $5-$10 each. Now, I can build you random numbers for half that price. Tell you what, I'll sell you random numbers for half that price, and you mark it. Is this a business or what? The business of selling random numbers. It's the trust. We trust them that it's random. Why should I trust these guys? With billions of dollars. I don't think so. That's another issue. All right, so how do you get real random numbers? That's a problem. Another problem is, how do you use them? It's really not that easy. It might be not too hard for me to print up a one-time tag. Suppose I had random characters and I could print up one. I guess I could use a laser printer to print two copies of every piece, right? There are problems that, you know, laser printers and other copiers tend to retain a little bit of the information from the last printout. But we'll imagine that we can do that pretty well. Oh, see, you know, if I use a typewriter that goes pound, 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 of course it leaves images on the ribbon. So generating that original random number without any residual data being hung around, without the ribbon, you know, being stolen and used, without the laser printer being abused, without the line between here and laser printer being abused. All right, but suppose I can do that. I've printed the piece of paper. Now, I have a sheet and you have a sheet, and I hand it to you. Now, we'd better keep it secret, right? If you ever fall asleep, for example, and somebody sneaks into your room and makes a duplicate, you'll never know. Then they'll be able to not only read your messages, but kill you off and send fake messages. Alright, it's called key management. It is a big key management problem associated with how you use these things. If you ever accidentally reuse one, you're screwed. All you have to do is go to 2.6, and it's all over. There are occasions when people have used the same item more than twice, and that's been decoded. Even though it was a one-time pad, it wasn't used properly. So you need to have a whole mechanism of procedures that you follow religiously in order to have this be effective. By the way, a one-time pad is what was used, probably still is used, to communicate between the premier, or I guess now president of the Soviet Union, now Russia, and the president of the United States. That's the red phone. Right? So in case of nuclear war, the president calls the premier, the red phone was run by a one-time pad. Okay, in this particular case, they had trusted couriers. You know, they'd have the Russian and the American couriers get together and generate their random numbers. They jointly carry the codes over to the Russian guy. They'd each guard them. It was in their both of their best interest to keep them very secret so they could communicate securely, so nobody else could thwart communication. So that's what that system was, at least purported to be. So, remember we said they're breakable. If H of K over size of M minus H of M is less than 1, less than or equal to 1. But breakable does not mean broken. The other thing that Shannon introduced in his 1949 paper was the concept of workload. That is, to actually break a message or to get a key, it takes doing a series of operations. And so the object of cryptography, any cryptography that isn't using the perfect cryptography, is to increase the workload to make it practically impossible, even though in theory it is possible. All Shannon proved that is if you have this situation, it can be broken. In theory, it is doable, but that doesn't mean you can actually do it. So we developed the concept of a workload to indicate how hard it might actually be to do it. And he figured out, or he believed, or he purported, that there were a couple of things that you could do, at least two things you could do to help increase the workload of a crypto system. One of them is called diffusion, the other one's called confusion. Diffusion is things that tend to diffuse the message and the key bits across the bits of the encrypted message. So if you have a message and a key, if you change a bit of the key or change a bit of the message, it should produce a 50-50 probability for each encrypted bit that bit changes. Okay? So that for all the bits across the whole encrypted stream, if you change one bit of key, there should be a 50-50 chance for each bit that it changes. That's diffusing the key across there, so that the key is not correlated to any small number of bits of the crypto, of the ciphertext and the plaintext. There's no bit of the ciphertext is associated with any subset of the bits of the ciphertext, plaintext, subtext. Confusion is anything that tends to confuse the relationship between inputs and outputs. Okay? So it's as opposed to spreading across, this says that any given bit of the output should have a 50-50 probability of being affected by a given bit of the input or the key. It's sort of, instead of spreading it out, they're coming together. Now, a lot of people say that diffusion and confusion are the same thing. And it's pretty darn difficult to say that they're wrong, because at least mathematically, you could claim that they were the same thing. But in practice, the way you implement them, that's not really true. So here is Shannon's model of cryptography. This is his model of what a crypto system looks like in the theoretical sense. Basically, you assume that the encryption mechanism, P sub B, and the decryption mechanism, P sub D, are known to the attacker. So if you have a box that does this magic, and I'm the bad guy, I have a copy of your box. Okay, and the reason for that assumption is a lot of history. The Germans assumed that we didn't have the Enigma cipher during World War II, but the Allies during World War II got a copy of the Enigma cipher. That was a bad assumption. So in order to eliminate those assumptions, you say, we're going to assume that the bad guy, the threat, has the mechanism that does encryption and decryption, and if the only secrets, oh, and also, of course, that they can read the ciphertext that's sent between that C that's sent between the encryption and decryption box. They can listen in on your signals. But the secrets are the plain text, the encryption and decryption key. Those are the only secrets. That's the assumption. Another thing about the model is that it assumes that that T sub E, that function T sub E, that it does encryption. When you apply K sub E in plain text to T sub E, you get C, the ciphertext. And when you take T sub D, the decryption mechanism, and apply K sub D, the decryption key, and C, the ciphertext, it gets out the plain text. There are also some important things to note. That is that the information content of the encryption and decryption keys need to be large. If they're not large, then I can exhaustively search the space of keys. I can try every key. And some of them are going to pop out with plain text, and because of the nature of language, it has structure, the probability of two substantially sized messages both making sense under different keys is very, very small. And you can actually compute it. Some people have, but not me. So the problem with DES was the key size was too small. Okay? The problem wasn't the 2.6 bit, the 2.6 work factor, the 2.6 unitary distance problem. The problem was that you could try all the keys, or a large portion of the keys. So if you try more and more keys, eventually you come across some plain text that's right, and you know you won. So, and then it's important that the content of the ciphertext is large. That is, if you're only sending one bit of information, then the fact that you sent it gives it away. You sent it. That's a bit of information, the fact that you sent it. So if you have very small content that you're sending, then it's not clear that these things will be effective. The relationship of the plain text to the ciphertext could also be obscure. Right? That is, you, somehow in this system, the whole goal is to obscure the relationship of the plain text to the ciphertext. So that's what Shannon's model is. There's a spatial model, another way of looking at it. The spatial model is that the goal is to hide something in a very large search space. So this little red dot inside this big blue glob. And so what we want to do is make it hard to find. And if you happen across it, we want to make it hard for you to know that you found it. Right? So it could look like all the rest of it. It's just another way of viewing this process of when you're encrypting, you're taking a plain text message and you're putting it into a form so that it's hidden inside the possibility of this enormous volume of other encrypted messages and plain text that it could have been. And if they can't get the key or do some other method of decrypting it, they'll never be able to figure out where it is in that big space. So there are various attacks on cryptosystems, and before long we'll be running to the end of this session, so we'll blaze through this and at the next convenience point break. But so basically there are a variety of methods for attacking cryptosystems. One of them is go around the system. They assume that you can't get P or KE or KD, so violate their assumption. Right? Cryptosystems, this model of cryptosystems is mathematical, but implementations are physical. So if I can tap your keyboard as you type the message, I don't have to break your cryptography. If I can get your key when you generate it or when you exchange it, I don't have to tap your cryptography. Okay, so violate the assumption. Another one is you cryptanalyze. For example, if you can cryptanalyze it by just looking at the ciphertext, which is what we were talking about earlier, I just used statistics on polyalphabetic substitution ciphers, and by looking at the ciphertext only, I can attack it. So that's a ciphertext-only attack. If I want to cryptanalyze from PC pairs, that is where I have a plain text and a ciphertext pair, that's called a known plain text attack. And there are lots of these. Right? If I know, for example, at the beginning of your messages, you always say, "Hi, Don." then that's a big lead. That means that I know a pair of, here's the plain text and here's the ciphertext. That gives me a big advantage in many crypto systems and breaking. So there are lots of those. Then another one is, instead of having their PC pairs, if I can have my PC pairs, if I can induce a U to encrypt a plain text and observe the ciphertext, that's called a selected or chosen plain text attack. Now, to give you an example, the RSA can be broken. I can get an RSA key in something like 2.6. What is it? I need to be able to send one. I need to have one block encrypted. No, I think I have to have two or two and a half blocks encrypted for every bit of key. Okay, so if you have a 1,000-bit key, I need a couple thousand blocks encrypted of my selection, and then I will have your key. Okay, so your private key. If you use it to encrypt my messages, I can eat you pretty quick. Give you an example. Okay, if I have a system that automatically encrypts your message and sends it to somebody else by sending it a sequence of things to encrypt and watching the encrypted messages, I can get the key to that system. Even though it's using a very big key length RSA, I can do it quickly and automatically. Okay, so all these automated signature systems, watch out. They're all susceptible to selected or chosen plain text attacks if they're using an RSA and that kind of mechanism. Another kind of attack is a protocol attack. The key distribution protocol might have a flaw. It allows me to prevent the distribution, so you keep using old keys. Lets me introduce a new key that wasn't supposed to be there. Lets me get at your key. Lets me cause you to redistribute an old key. Key maintenance. There are various mechanisms used to maintain, say, upgrade this key, or a mechanism that says this key is no good anymore, it's been hacked. If I can defeat the protocol that sends back the message that says this is no good, then even though the key is no good and you have a key revocation mechanism, the mechanism isn't effective. User behavior. The user always signs on, says, hi, Dion. Exploit the user behavior to get a, for example, a known plain text. Exploit the fact that the user, you know, is in a room and you can look over his shoulder and he types in his password. Exploit the system behavior. The system doesn't generate random numbers. And a good example is the Kerberos servers. They generated their keys based on a time, and they had to be time synchronized. So based on when the key was generated, you could tell within maybe less than a minute what the system time was. Use that to generate all the random numbers that could be generated in that time frame, and you could break the Kerberos session key by using that. Now, they fixed that particular one, but there are all sorts of other system behaviors in this protocol of how things are done that might be susceptible in any crypto system. So other examples, replay attack. Play the same encrypted message again and again. For example, transfer $1,000 from Bank of America into my account, please. And they make the transfer because they owed you $1,000. You capture the encrypted message and you play it again and again and again. And the transfer happens again and again and again. It was all authenticated, it was all authorized. You didn't do any. You don't even know what the crypto system did. All you know is this sequence of bits got me $1,000. I kept doing it. Timing attacks. Delay a message until an appropriate time. Like, we need this troop movement. Okay, we know that they want you to move here. We block the message. 5 minutes later, we're going to replay it after we've set the trap. Okay, 5 minutes later, we send the encrypted message. It's still valid. It decodes right. Let's move. Boom. You're dead. Man-in-the-middle attack. In the key distribution process, you forge, you know, for Joe, you forge being Bill, and for Bill, you forge being Joe. So Bill thinks you're Joe, and Joe thinks you're Bill, and every time Bill sends something to Joe, you receive it, you send it off, and when the message comes back, you receive it and send it back. It's a man-in-the-middle attack. They both believe each other are who they are, They both trust that it is the other, and you're listening into everything, and you can modify the messages on the way, and you can induce new messages. And neither of them will ever know. Are there more kinds of attacks on crypto systems? Well, the answer is there's no general theory of the class of all attacks on crypto systems. So no matter how many attacks I list, there might be many, many more kinds of attacks out there. Nobody can ever say that we're out, that all possibilities have been covered, at least not today. All of these systems, except the one-time pad, depend on not having big mathematical or computational breakthroughs. Who knows? One day, space alien or, you know, brilliant mathematician from Milwaukee shows up and says, oh, that's easy. Shift this left by 3, multiply it by 18, shoot a laser at this thing, bend this piece of plastic, and you'll get the answer. You may laugh, but it's true. Optical computing, for example, offers the potential that you could create a lens that would absolutely, instantaneously solve any RSA crypto. So, you shine a light, the message comes in on a laser beam, whoop, here's the answer, here's the key. Entirely possible. Nobody's done it yet, but it's possible. Somebody might figure out how to do it. And that crypto system would be dead. Dead as a doornail. Any of these systems could fall over tomorrow, except the one-time pad, in a big way. They are breakable. So, you know, when you think about crypto, you know, you got to think pretty hard about these issues and about what kind of risk you're managing and what you're trusting this encryption mechanism to do. There are some subtypes of crypto systems. There's the symmetric key. This is a case where the encryption and decryption keys are identical. So anyone with a key can forge or read any message in that kind of system. The DES is such a system. Another one is symmetric transform, where the transform for encryption is the same as the transform for decryption. So to a close approximation, DES is a case where the keys are symmetric and the transforms are symmetric. Okay. Public key is a case where possession of one key does not yield use of the other key. And it can be used for authentication. You do that by releasing the decryption key. Right? So I can encrypt and you can decrypt, which means you can authenticate it with me because nobody else could have encrypted. For secrecy, I release the encryption key. You encrypt. Of course, I release both, that's no good. But I just release an encryption key. And you can encrypt and nobody else can read the message except me. And then you can have both of those, that is, where it's symmetric so that KE and KD both work for either purpose. And that's what the RSA is. RSA is a symmetric public key crypto system where I can hand you one key and I keep the other key. We call it the public key and the private key. And your key can be used to encrypt the message and send it to me, or I can encrypt the message and you can certify, verify that it was from me by the fact that you can decrypt it. Okay, please note, if I send you a message, I sign it, so to speak, right? I encrypt it with my key. And you get the message, and you verify it was from me. You're verifying that message was from me. But if somebody else makes a copy of the ciphertext and sends it to me again, I got the message again. The message says, sell $3,000 a golf. And I send it again, and you're going to sell $6,000 worth of golf. And if I send it again, you're going to send $9,000. Okay? Replay. Oh, good. That's a convenient place to break. Question? Well, the question of what does Secure Shell do? Has a very specific protocol. There are different versions of Secure Shell that do different specific things. And there are good papers on the specifics of what Secure Shell does. But generally what they do is they'll start out with a key distribution, so it's susceptible to a man-in-the-middle attack. Okay? The first time you contact a remote site, it doesn't know what the remote key is. So it'll basically say, give me your public key. Here's my public key, what's yours? And it'll exchange. All right, now you've got public key, and now you use the public key, you generate a pseudo-random number, you encrypt it with the other guy's public key and say, here's the session key, let's talk 3Dev. And the other guy says, I don't have 3Dev, how about if we talk Dev? You say, okay, Dev is good to me. You're now talking Dev, and that's the key. All this has been encrypted only with the public key. Now once you're talking Dev with the session key, for the remainder of the session, you're just running Dev back and forth. Or whatever idea or whatever cipher you've agreed on for the session. Okay? Now, man-in-the-middle attack. The first time you contact Joe's computer, I sit in the middle. You ask for Joe, I say, here I am. I call Joe, say, hi, Joe. Joe says, I'm Bill. I'm Jason. I'm Bill. He says, okay, Bill, nice to know you. Now, I keep both of your keys. Each of you thinks you're talking to the other, but it's all going through me. You send off a session key to Bill, and I say, okay, here's my session key. I create a different session key over to Joe. I do all the translation. I can listen in the middle. I can type in the middle and so forth. Now, in SSH, if you've done that once, if you change crypto keys on one side, or if somebody substitutes another box, it'll say, sorry, I can't communicate. I have a different public key this time than last time. So once you've initialized it, if that works properly, then you're relatively safe. Might be relatively, because there are other complications. For example, how does it generate the pseudo-random number for that second key? How secure is the box it's sitting on, and so forth? And, we'll get to more of that. Other questions?